This is Media Sales Mastery, the podcast for media sales professionals. In each episode, we bring you information, insights, and ideas from some of the industry's top thought leaders. Connect with us to help pick the topic and guide the show.
This is Media Sales Mastery, the podcast for media sales professionals. I am your host, Jamie Wood. Our topic today, ethical dilemmas. Now, there is a tension and a trade-off that manifests daily in media sales. You are serving multiple stakeholders, you're representing competing interests, you're balancing politics, priorities, and personalities. And whilst it's your role to advocate for the customer, you also represent the business. Whilst it's your job to help the customer grow their business, you're remunerated based on short-term revenue incentives. There's a lot kind of here in this very grey, murky area. So our guest today is Tim Murphy. Tim is actually my former boss. I'll let him give a little bit more on his background, but the goal of today's episode is to throw up some scenarios that are very common, that occur almost daily, and then give some advice on how to kind of navigate these ethical dilemmas. In a media sales role, these come up all the time, so nothing here will be new or fresh to anyone who's a frontline seller, but hopefully some of the thinking, some of the strategies and tactics that we give to overcome them will feel new and will give you a bit of a different perspective to approach them. So let's get into that now.
The first five.
Tim, welcome.
Thank you, Jamie. Great to be here, mate.
Good to talk to you again, mate. And first of all, what's interesting about having you on is this is the first time I think I've had a former boss on the podcast. So good to have you on, mate. And you've always been a big supporter of the pod. So thank you for that. Tell us a bit about your background, your career to date in the media world.
Yeah, Jamie. So I kicked off in what can only be described as an apprenticeship, a media apprenticeship at the old Mitchell & Partners in the very early 2000s, worked in that business for about five and a half years, and that's the organisation that today we know as Dentsu. So worked with the Mitchell family and a whole range of other legends and icons of the industry, many of whom are still kicking around in various roles, and many of which are doing terrific and being significant contributors to the industry. So that was a wonderful apprenticeship, and then jumped across to a little out-of-home representation business called Network Outdoor in 2006, mid-2006, and that was Brendan Cook's business, another legend and icon of the industry, and was part of the journey of building that business into what we know today as oMedia. So I was there for over 16 years, finishing up there earlier this year, 2022, loved every minute of it. A terrific experience building a business through acquisition, organic growth, being part of great winning teams and high performance, a lot of fun along the way, and currently enjoying a moment to breathe and really excited about an opportunity and a challenge in 2024, early 24 to kick off on the executive team at QMS. So, it's been a couple of roles over a long period of time. Loved every minute of being part of the industry and, mate, excited to have a chat today. Love what you do and the passion and energy you've got for coaching and helping people across our industry. So excited to have a chat today and catch up with you, mate.
No, me too, mate. And this actually was an interesting topic to try and pull together because I guess it's something that I do get a lot of questions on LinkedIn about. Like if you were to kind of go, what's the theme that people usually submit questions to the podcast or want some guidance on? And it seems to kind of fall under this banner of ethical dilemmas, which is, it was just interesting designing it, really how easy it was to come up with examples. In your observation, mate, why is it almost a bit of a daily occurrence that there's some difficult decisions that media salespeople kind of have to make that have to balance different objectives and different different stakeholders?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure what I did to deserve the opportunity to tackle this topic with you, Jamie. Obviously, somewhere along the lines I've done something to be tasked with ethical dilemmas as the subject of choice. There'll be some people out there listening now probably understanding very clearly why. No, you're right. It is. It's a pressure point, a challenge area for anyone, be it in a leadership role or in a sales or business management sales representative role. As you say, you're dealing with a huge range of stakeholders, all of whom have different intent. Now, there's a holistic intent around doing great work and driving great outcomes for a customer, for a client, but the way to get there, or some of the nuances within, those outcomes drive different intent across different stakeholders. So, that's always going to play a role. But even then, internally, within any organisation, there's different pressure points. There's some competing focuses, and then even at a personal level, there's people who we've all come across it. You work with different people who have got their own objectives and their own ways of doing things. So, one of the things that I think we'll explore through this topic is around what is the value system, or what is that sort of set of foundational principles that you're working towards. And unless that's really clearly communicated across a whole business, from top to bottom, from far left to far right, you're going to be faced with ethical dilemmas or decisions that need to be made that may potentially transgress a moral set of principles every single day. So yeah, it's a great topic, as you say, and I think I'm looking forward to tackling it with you.
Yes, well, it's a perfect setup, and yes, you have had the misfortune of being the person who has to tackle this with me, but let's get into it now.
Media Sales Mastery.
Because what I'm planning to do is throw some scenarios at you, and I guess what I'd love to hear is how you'd sort of interpret these and kind of work through them.
Yep, okay.
So let's just go into the first one. Client wants to buy, but you worry it's not enough budget for them to actually have a successful campaign. So pretty simple one, in the sense that maybe this is a number that could get you to your budget. Maybe this is a piece of business that your sales manager is very enthusiastic about you closing. But in your heart of hearts, you know that potentially the client is going to have a less than positive experience based on the level of investment they're putting in. How does this one typically sort of work through as a framework for you and your decision-making as to how to proceed?
Yeah, so firstly, let me just make sure there's no sort of callback number here, is there, where people are going to ring up and tell me that I'm saying things that I haven't done over the years? Hopefully not. But so we'll take this as things I've learned and would like to take forward. I would hope that any suggestions I bring forward through the next half an hour or so align to the way that I have carried myself over the years. But look, this is a relatively common one, I imagine, for people in the sales side of the business out there, or even potentially if you're in an agency and you're dealing with a client who's wanting to achieve a lot but doesn't have a big budget, the same kind of scenario is faced. I think what you've got, if you, let's say you take the money and run, is you've probably got a relatively small, by the sound of it, one-time customer or one-time spender, because what you're going to, you're going to take the money in, and then what you're going to present to them, or the solution that they're going to, that's going to be executed, isn't going to work. It's not going to drive an outcome, and so you'll probably never hear from them again. The way I'd be looking at this is an opportunity to collaborate and engage in a really positive way, be as honest as you possibly can around what it is that you can offer, but then explore some different options with them, be them using a competitor, be them using another medium, another agency if it's on that side of the fence. Get into the ideation and the collaboration space with them, and see if you can't offer them some great counsel and some great advice in that regard. Now, you mightn't get the dollars in that moment, but you're giving yourself an opportunity to build a different type of relationship, one that's hopefully a little longer lasting, and you're going to build a relationship with a customer that might come back with more money next time, and build some longer lasting success. So that's how I would be looking to step through that particular scenario.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good call, mate, because the initial impression might be, if you flag the concern, the client might not spend or might not proceed with the campaign. But it's been my experience that sharing those reservations or having that disclaimer up front I can't think of any time where it's ever actually caused the client not to proceed. I think it's, if anything, it's just been appreciated that there is a bit of that transparency, and it's left the door open for future conversations. You know, the opposite is kind of putting your fingers in your ears and going, let's just hope for the best. It's like that never goes well. So I think that's a great suggestion. What about this one? You uncover, so you as the rep, you uncover a major error in delivery that the client isn't aware of and likely won't find out about.
Never happened in my time. In out-of-home advertising, we've never had that problem. Never had a delivery issue. No, that's obviously not true. This is almost a daily occurrence as the out-of-home industry specifically sort of made that really big step change from classic or static to digital, right? Yeah, this was something we were faced with on a regular basis. That one learning is that you may think that they are likely they won't find out. They will find out. It's just about how that happens. But in the rare instance where they won't find out, I think, look, the first thing to do is really define the scenario, so really understand what it is that you're dealing with. So what are all the consequences? Who are all the stakeholders that are going to be impacted? And be really, really work as quickly as you can to evaluate and understand all of that. And then get to work on what solutions can be. Now, at this stage, you still don't necessarily need to have determined exactly how and what you are communicating, but what you want to be building out is what are the avenues that we have available to us here. I would always be in this moment thinking around how do we overcompensate? So what's the worst thing that can play out here? And then how do we overcompensate? How do we make things as seamless as we can from this point on? How do we ensure that the issue has been corrected and can't happen again? What steps, what procedures are we putting in place as quickly as possible to arrest the scenario or the problem that has come about? And then I would be, really working with all stakeholders internally to line up a set of communications with the relevant customer, the relevant client to get on top of it and get front-footed, because as I say, you may think it's very likely that they won't find out, but they will. You're much better off to present to them a holistic scenario, what's happened, why it's happened, what you've done to stop it from happening again, how are they going to be compensated, and how every sort of stakeholder engaged is or impacted is going to be supported moving forward. So I think you earn respect from communicating and connecting in that way. And whilst it can be a bit of a big gulp moment, you're looking there at a longer lasting outcome than that particular moment in time. So that's how I'd probably step through that. They're tricky situations, but they're all too common, and you get quite good at dealing with them, unfortunately. Hopefully that answers that question.
No, it does. And I think I was reflecting a bit on this one because I think you can't put a price on peace of mind. Like, they likely won't find out. It's like, let's say you went, oh, let's just roll the dice.
Yep.
I mean, that's, I'd be losing sleep over that one. The difference with this scenario too to me is it's fortunate to be in a position where you've uncovered it rather than the client's uncovered it. And brought it to your attention, because then you actually have time to formulate a game plan and a communication plan back to the client. It's actually a fortunate position to be in versus the client calls you with the grievance and then you're having to respond in real time.
I think that's right. If you can be front-footed, it gives you a great chance to, I suppose, lead through the scenario rather than being back-footed. Going into specifics, because not the environment nor the time. I think you and I probably had a couple of these ourselves, in your time at O, where you've got choices to make. And if you can get on the front foot, you're gonna be granted respect each and every time.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. And we certainly did have some doozies in our time, but as you probably know, like it's no media is immune to it, right? Like I think you know, my time in radio, the odd host who just decided to go completely off script and drop a clanger on air, and then suddenly you've got a client on the end of the line. Like every medium seems to have their kind of, shall I say, like their risk points or exposure points where problems can and do happen. Here's one that's probably more universal to any media. So you're maybe an agency rep, and you might work on a portfolio where you actually service a couple of major clients that are actually competing brands. So maybe you've got a couple of insurers or a couple of fast food companies or something to that effect. So you have an insight into two competing brands and their strategies, and you get asked to share some details by one of them on what the other is doing.
Mm. Yeah, look, this is, again, good scenario. Look, there's available avenues for advertisers and agencies out there to get insight around what their competitors are doing. There's a lot of ways they can already do that. I think leaning on a media supplier, to be fair, I think that's pretty unfair. That's putting somebody in a really challenging spot. Now, I'm not sure if you're across or any of the pod followers across the Plus model. It's a really basic sort of problem solving model, pretty that leans into, I suppose, ethical dilemmas. It's the Plus stands for policies, legal, universal, and self. Basically, it allows you to step through a scenario and just use these filters to determine whether you are, let's call it, transgressing a moral principle. So, do you have policies and procedure in place that says that clearly outlines whether you can or cannot do a certain thing, behave in a certain way, act in a certain way? Then there's legal. So again, really clear. Contractually, are you obliged to do something in a certain way, not share information X, Y, or Z? The universal is what company values and foundations are in place that you need to adhere to, that you should be aware of, that have been communicated to you and your peers. And then self, the S is self. What are your own values? What do you feel is right and wrong? And if you step through the Plus model in this scenario, I think 9.5 times out of 10, in fact, let's just call it 10 out of 10 times, it's going to be a very clear no.
Mm.
Don't share the information, the valuable insight that you're granted from one competitor or one customer with another. I think 10 times out of 10, using that Plus model, that would come up with that's not the right thing to do. That would be my take on that scenario.
No, I agree. I think if anything, everyone's pretty clear that this is a no-go, I would hope. But I think the one thing is maybe like if you are on the receiving end of that request, There are probably some techniques that you can use to kind of very softly kind of push back on that. You know, it's not just a case of going, sorry, that's confidential. It might be something to the effect of, well, look, there are some case studies we might have on the category. Maybe you can talk more broadly about the category, but it's that fine line between what is kind of information that is available in the public domain and you're just simply there curating and passing on versus what's information that you are clearly privy to that is proprietary or confidential or, you know, shared with you in confidence. So I think that Plus framework sounds fantastic. That's a great framework to utilize.
Well, I'm a basic guy, Jamie, you know that. I try to have just basic sort of frameworks available to me in challenging scenarios, and that's a really basic one. So, you're right. There is so much available data and information out there for advertisers and agencies steer them in the right direction with what you feel comfortable with, but have a framework in place. So, or a little checklist or a filter system, whatever it is that works for you, that you can quickly lean on. That will allow you to make the decision or make a choice that you yourself feel really comfortable in.
Well, here's one that I don't think is much of an ethical dilemma. You get sent a competitor's media kit or rate card by accident. Mm. I'm not losing too much sleep over forwarding that one to some internal people, but how would you view that one?
That's we haven't talked about this, but I would agree, mate. I mean, just check your emails, people. don't send the wrong thing to the wrong person. Yeah. And look, you know, there's a couple of Tim Murphys in the media world out there. There's a couple of them, and they would have got some weird stuff that was meant for me over the years, and vice versa. And depending on who they were and where they worked at the time, yeah, you have a little peek, don't you? No real dramas with that one. Again, I think you go back to the person who sent it. If something's landed in the inbox by accident, you let them know that it's gone to the wrong spot, and then they probably freak out, worrying what's going to happen with it. Don't widely share, but I won't say that I haven't had a little peek at things that have landed in the inbox incorrectly. Yep.
Yeah, what's funny is like how much of a big deal it seems like, but how little actually gets done with that collateral when it gets shared. You know, it's like, right. Oh, we've got our hands on this. It's like, what are we actually doing off the back of this beyond throwing a few comments out or having a few digs? Here's one that actually probably is a little bit of a different – it's sort of like a different version of an earlier problem. An internal approval has maybe been skipped over or been missed. You've got the revenue coming in. So you're a rep. Maybe you needed a pricing sign-off, or maybe there was some sort of an approval you needed. You didn't get it either through ignorance or just through just pure accident. Mm-hmm. Do you raise it when the revenue is potentially coming in, or is it one of those things of going, here's 100,000 reasons to say, yes, we got the booking? How would we play that one?
Mm. Look, I'm all for entrepreneurial spirit and, you know, a commercial mindset. So I'm probably thinking about this one more. So if it's, let's say it's been missed, a step has been missed, and there's acknowledgement it's been missed. Now we've got the chance to go back. I think that's what you're sort of asking, right? You got the chance to go back.
Yeah.
So look, there's one thing worse than not getting revenue in the door. It's getting revenue in the door and then having to take it out again. And there's a lot of steps that are put in place, sometimes too many, no doubt, but there's steps and there's process that are put in place by leaders of business not to be annoying or to be an unnecessary pain in the backside, but to mitigate risk largely. That's why these steps are in place. So they are important. And they're meant to be adhered to. And if there's a reason why a particular step in the in that transaction chain has been avoided or missed, the likelihood is, again, it's coming back to that almost the original scenario we talked about, is don't find yourself in a spot here where the money is going to get taken away, you know. And even just as an individual who's got a role to play in that process, don't be known as someone who's avoiding necessary process. It doesn't bode well. You want to be seen as someone who's entrepreneurial. You want to be seen as someone who's got a competitive mindset. You want to be seen as someone who wants to win and get the revenue in the door. But you want to be seen as someone who appreciates, you know, the steps and the structure that's in play. It's there for a reason. So again, I would be calling that out before the cash lands. I've been too many times have I reported on revenue and then you sort of tiptoeing back a few days later saying you know you wouldn't believe it, but X and Y and whatever office in whatever team didn't do A, B, and C, and now we've incorrectly reported on revenue and we've got to take revenue out, and that's worse than having it there in the first place, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and I think particularly from the client's perspective, it's always a bad experience for them. You know, it's like there's some internal angst, but very rarely missing that approval, does it ever work out well for the client when they do actually go to book it? This one comes up a lot, I think, across the board in media. And I think out of home would definitely be a test case because it's such an emotional, in many cases, it's a very emotional and subjective kind of buy for clients. A major piece of inventory has sold that you had included on a client's plan. You're expecting the client's approval, but telling them that major piece of inventory is now unavailable could jeopardize the entire deal. Do you fall back on the caveat subject to availability at time of booking, or is this something that needs to be disclosed and potentially, you know, rebriefed to market?
Yeah, you're right. Really prevalent in out-of-home. I mean, as the Network Outdoor, which became oMedia business, was growing and you had such, let's call it at times, quite a restricted portfolio of assets to use, and some were highly, highly demanded and some weren't. This was a really common scenario that we faced. Not so much sort of in recent years when you start to build out such a massive platform available, as is available across all the major out-of-home providers today. But yeah, look, I think again, not knowing, or this is, you know, a general scenario, but that it'll be nuanced here, because you will know, and even if we use the plus model again, you go to self, you'll know yourself here, who you're dealing with, what's the flow been of that conversation or that negotiation to date. You know, are you communicating really regularly? Are you giving updates from both sides? You know, is the agency or the advertiser giving you updates along the way with where they're at from a budget approval process, from a planning perspective? Are you updating them on a schedule that might be shifting around a little bit as the days go on? Or has it been a bit of a standoff, you know? Has it been going on for weeks and weeks and weeks? Are there clear deadlines and expectations in play around the process? So I think that you'll have to, yeah, dive quite deep into yourself and those around you that you're working with to sort of evaluate the process so far. That process around that particular piece of business will help determine, I think, the way you go here. What I would be doing either way is building out some really strong alternative solutions. So get yourself really ready. It's a bit like that one where you don't think the client's going to find out about a delivery issue. They probably are, right? Now, in this one here, you're faced with a scenario where they definitely will, and a lot of it's down to timing. So what are some really strong alternative solutions that you can build out? Have them ready to go. If you feel really, really confident in what those solutions are, get on the front foot again, put them to the client, explain the scenario, you'll get respect by doing so, and you can get to work on retaining that available revenue or that revenue you believe is coming, and still offering up a really strong proposition that's going to drive great outcomes. That's how I'd be positioning it. So I suppose I've gone a bit full circle there, but know the scenario that you're in. How's the communication been flowing? I think that probably sets a bit of a trend or a bit of a, you know, that probably gives you an avenue that you can explore. Yeah, get to work on the available solutions. And I think, yeah, again, most times here, getting on the front foot is going to prove to be the winning approach.
Yeah. And what I like about that answer is that it is unique, and it is, you know, it's not a black or white scenario that you're dealing with, right, when this thing comes up. There's a lot of variability that comes into it. What I would say too, though, is your whole piece around alternative solutions, I think that's one that I find can be really risky, or can create a lot of risk when a salesperson finds something they know the client really wants, and then suddenly their whole solution is anchored to like that one thing, that idea, that talent, that piece of inventory, that site. And where that can be great is obviously you can create a bit of urgency, you can create a bit of FOMO with the client. It can be a great sales tool. The problem is obviously that if your whole value proposition is tied up in that one unique thing, then you're going to really be at risk of whether that thing is available or not at the time. So I think that was a great call too, is always be thinking around what's your contingency plan, or how do you sell an idea or sell a solution that is a bit modular, that you can tweak and still kind of retain the essence of what you're trying to achieve. So
no, that's right. Yeah, and look, and to your point, if a solution is so reliant on that one asset, then what you should be doing is putting some very clear process in place around the management of that particular asset. You know, so how long can you, let's not use the term, well, I shouldn't, but, you know, how can you take something offline? How can you protect that asset? How can you create that competitive intensity? How clearly can you communicate and set that expectation to the buyer, so that everybody, all the stakeholders are completely clear around what risk is at play here, you know? So yeah, it's a great scenario. It's a really common scenario, particularly in a medium that has finite inventory. You know, there are tangible, real assets in the ground in out of home. You know, back in the old days, magazines, you know, keep putting pages in, but there are a lot of medium out there that have finite inventory, and inventory management is an ongoing challenge.
Yeah, and I think just to round that point out, like, the thing about a client maybe losing that piece of inventory that they really wanted, if you're playing a long game or taking a long-term view, it actually can be a positive thing. Mm-hmm. Because anyone who sits on an approval, or, you know, sort of drags the chain, for want of a better term, and then they lose that, they're going to be a little bit quicker moving next time around. So sometimes it's about looking at over the long term as well, and going, well, maybe there's some downside in the short term, but over the long term, we know this client values this asset. We know that them sort of seeing a tangible example of it selling, like we maybe forewarned them it would, is going to mean that they're more inclined to move quickly on the next couple of deals. Yep. As well. A client needs to cancel due to a legitimate reason, but doing so would take you and the team under budget. I don't know. I think I lost count of how many times that happened over the last 3 years. How does this one... I guess in the world of any media, we all have cancellation terms and clauses. So what I think I'm maybe sort of suggesting here is a scenario where the client is asking for a concession to that cancellation clause due to some sort of legitimate reason, like a disruption to their business or some sort of material force majeure type of event. How does this one get sort of worked through in your mind?
Yeah, I'm mindful of not publicly setting precedent here. I started a new job early in the year. I'm not sure what their policies are, but look, empathy is going to play a big part here, right? So having understanding and being empathetic to the scenarios or the impact on all stakeholders is important. I say that from, you know, potentially the person or the organisation that is having activity cancelled, but also, you know, on behalf of the canceller, is to be really aware of the impact of what's being done here. I think this is one of those situations where great problem solvers, great leaders step up on both sides. And it actually has the opportunity or presents the opportunity to create, and not dissimilar to what you were just referring to there around some sold inventory, this has the opportunity to steer great long-term outcomes, relationships, positive working relationships, collaboration, etc. Because you can build a lot of respect through these moments. Look, the first thing I would be doing, no matter what sort of level within the organization you are, is socialize the situation. Socialize it, talk to people, evaluate it, understand it, appreciate and be empathetic to the impact on everybody, and then get to work on ideas and solutions, again, alternative solutions to how do we play this out? How do we play this out so that we can minimise that the negative impact, and we can get as close as possible to a compromise as we can. And there's lots of different ways to do that. There's really creative ways to step through these scenarios, explore them all, come to the table, and get to work on it. What doesn't work is blunt, unemotional demands in this, and or blunt, unemotional blockages, you know. Get to work on it. It can drive great outcomes, and try to find a compromise. You know, as you say, COVID era was unique in this regard. I think we all got very, very good at creative problem solving. So there's some skills there that have probably been really enhanced. There's some muscles that have been flexed and trained up over that period that we can lean on when these situations, for whatever reason, occur today or pop up. So empathy is the big one, and get to work on a compromise, and you're probably going to drive some really great long-lasting outcomes.
Yeah.
From these scenarios.
I think the big one here too is – repeat offenders, separating out a repeat offender versus an isolated legitimate case is a big one too, because there are scenarios where some clients maybe do, it's an expectation, or maybe there's like four or five of these scenarios versus where it is legitimate, you know, a legitimate once-off where the client needs empathy. So, mate, I think that's a great framework. Let's talk about this one, because this one's a bit difficult to articulate, but I think everybody knows what I mean here. Let's say you are inside a business, you're a frontline seller, and you might be privy to seeing a great campaign idea in a team meeting, or you might see a great proposal that goes out the door, or there might be a really nice piece of strategy work that's been purpose-built for a client, and you want to take that work to another client. So I guess it's kind of like that world of unsold ideas, or, you know, repurposing collateral that's maybe been created for another client. How do you navigate what is and isn't appropriate in a scenario like that, where it can be a bit subjective as to what is appropriate versus what is not?
I think there's two elements here that are, there's two ingredients that are critical: time and communication. So timelines in all of this are important. But then what's most important is communication. So, and I'd probably preface that or reference that to over-communication. So, you know, how are you setting a policy or a process that you can really clearly articulate to a client, to a customer, around that proposal or an idea, a concept, whatever it may be, so that there is no confusion around what your appetite is to present that to others. You know, so we're here today to present this to you, and in 3 weeks' time, we'll be presenting it to a whole range of other potential advertisers, competitors, whatever it may be. You know, be really, really clear. Leave no doubt whatsoever in, because again, you've got commercial requirements as a business to get to work, to bring this to life. And if it's not with customer A, it can be with customer B. So, and there's no issue in creating some of that intensity within a sector, within a competitive set. If it's great. If it's great work, if it's going to drive great outcomes, if it's something you're really proud of and confident in. So, yeah, setting a really clear process, communicating that, over-communicating that, being really, really clear in how you communicate that to every single potential stakeholder through that process, and then back yourself in to get to work on getting it out there. I mean, you know, you see this with things like the Olympics for next year, how a nine and a QMS, you know, who have got sponsorship packages available, how they step through that is can be seen as quite complicated and challenging. But if you strip it back and just look at it in as simple terms as you can, you prioritize who's customer group A, B, C, D. You communicate that really clearly to the market, to your teams. And you stick to that process, and you get to work on it. They've got to sell those packages. It's vital to their success, and they need the time to do it. So time and communication would be my two key ingredients to a scenario like that.
Yeah, and I'm glad that was the answer you took, mate, because I was thinking about this. I think it's more often the case that people get a bit shy about doing this. At all, which is actually a real missed opportunity. Like, if you think about the amount of time and energy that and resourcing that companies put into building strategic documents and coming up with ideas and, you know, pitching stuff that sort of doesn't necessarily get bought, like having a bit of a process where a lot of stuff can either be revisited or repurposed or reformulated for another client, it's actually good business. Like, it's actually just really efficient use of resourcing and maximizing opportunity. So I think this one, to me, it's almost the opposite of don't feel shy about it. Just make sure that the way you're doing it, to your great point, is transparent and is done so with some common sense there as well. Okay, last one. Last one. Your sale. Well, last one before the listener question. Your sales manager wants you to close a piece of business by creating urgency, scarcity, i.e., telling the client someone else wants to buy it. What do we think about that one? How would we approach that?
Look, everyone's got tactics, right? So the buyers have got tactics. The sales guys have got tactics. The clients have got tactics. So everyone's using what they can within the positive realm of the moral principles and values or ethics, if you will, that they're comfortable with. I think creating a bit of urgency and competitive intensity is not a silly thing. It's a tactic that's often used. It's probably frequently dismissed, but sometimes it works. So I would be don't lie blatantly, you know, don't trip up yourself, but absolutely. If what you have on the table is strong and you know that it's demanded you've got a revenue timeline that you're working to or a sign-off timeline that you're working towards, yeah, push. I think there's no issue in using those tactics. But again, don't trip yourself up. Don't lie blatantly about it. But if you're confident in what's on the table, if you're confident in the proposition that you're putting forward, you're confident it's going to drive great outcomes for a customer, and if it's not this one, it's another one, then, yeah, drive some competitive intensity. You know, push for sign-off. That's what the great sales people do, not only in our industry but in all industry. So back yourself in. Get the job done. That's what you're there to do.
Yeah, nice one. All right, listener question time.
I can't ask my sales manager that.
This one's interesting. Keen to hear your perspective.
It seems like often in media sales, when it comes to communicating with clients and agencies, telling them the exact nature of what's going on is not appropriate. I don't think we should be dishonest, but often when I'm faced with filtering client comms, I tend to withhold certain info. Is honesty always the best policy, or do you need to have some flexibility or creativity around which information you choose to share?
That's a really well articulated question. Mm. And I think I have a really good understanding of what they're trying to kind of articulate there. Keen to hear your initial impression of that one.
Is a good question. You said that was a listener question, Jamie.
Yeah, it came through on LinkedIn.
Okay. Great question. Look, we were just talking about tactics there, and I think this probably moves away a little bit from tactics into, let's call it more around relationship strategy, and having and building that trust that you need in place to, you know, do great work together, make sure that you've got customers that they're returning and feeling really, really comfortable and really confident in the work they do with you, you know, and then they keep investing and keep innovating, keep growing, and everyone's winning, you know, in that scenario. Look, there's going to be lines to cross around which commercially sensitive information shouldn't sort of transgress between different stakeholders. But I think it's really important, and in our industry in particular, that we know and love is that we try to understand and be empathetic to the real needs and ambitions of each other's companies and each other's organisations. And if we can, you know, have that empathy or be empathetic to what that line, where that line is, then, you know, that hopefully allows us to make sort of better informed decisions, to communicate or collaborate with more clarity and make better decisions when it comes time to problem solve. So, and if, you know, we're doing that on each side of the fence, then the impact is going to be really positive. It's going to be a long-lasting success, you know. So, look, it's a really interesting question. I think on the most part, honesty is always the best policy. But having that empathy that we've all got slightly different. We come, you know, this is how we sort of started the chat, is everyone's got nuances in their intent and their ambition. And just be empathetic of that, be understanding of that, and that should help to steer what information is and isn't shared. What a great question, and I don't think I've answered it very well at all. If I was honest,
I think you've done a great job, because I struggled with this one. I think the biggest thing that I kind of thought here was, don't do anything dishonest, but you absolutely should take some time to filter and position the information in a way that is going to be received correctly. You know what I mean? And so what I mean by that is, don't go to the client and go, here's the nature of the issue. These four things in the business happened, and this happened, and that. Like, you can be a little bit more sort of, there's a bit more polish you can put behind that. Like, you know, we found an issue in the workflow. We've done this, blah, blah, blah. Like, I think to me, it's about, just think about it from the perspective of the person receiving that information. How is it best filtered and delivered? What information is irrelevant? What information could actually cause that client to have a negative reaction that doesn't necessarily need to be shared? And that's probably the gray area, right? Like, because obviously you want to be transparent. But to me, I think it's a really well-answered question. I think you did a great job answering it, mate. So we're at the end, but I have one final question for you. And thank you, mate. I've really enjoyed this chat. It's been great to have you tackle our most controversial topic yet.
It was great to squeeze you into my very busy schedule at the moment.
Yes, I hear you've got a bit going on at the moment. So the last question is one that I think I'd be keen for your perspective, because you've led award-winning teams for many years, and you've nurtured and coached a lot of careers. What do you think, in your estimation, are the hallmarks of a really great media sales professional? If you see somebody and you maybe have a quick moment to make an assessment as to whether they're going to be successful or not in this space, what is it that you think are some of those key attributes?
Great question. Look, I've always been really big on giving people who are coachable and great listeners an opportunity. And then giving them time and giving them the right support to grow. And people grow and develop at different timelines. It takes different people different ways to grow and develop. But just making sure that you've set people up with right support. And if they're coachable, they'll get there, right? It's such a brilliant industry filled with terrific people that if you're sociable and you've got some confidence you've got a willingness to listen and learn, anybody can make a real go of it in media in this country, which is awesome, right? So I've often said to people, I think someone who can dream big, someone who can get shit done, and somebody can have fun, they're the kinds of people that I like working with, and it's pretty simple stuff. But they're some of the ingredients that I look for in people. And as I say, it's an industry that just gives people opportunity and gives them time in most cases to be able to develop and grow and explore. When I stepped through that. The first 5 or 6 years of my career at Mitchell & Partners, I made some unbelievably silly errors on and off the field. But, I got given opportunities. I had people who invested time and I just soaked it all up. I went to everything. I got to know as many people as I possibly could. I just loved getting into the social element of this industry, what it was back then, and it still is today. I love spending time with people, listening to stories, learning by listening and watching and just being part of it. And you see those people that come into our industry and they start soaking it up. They're always there. You see them there, and you can see that they're the ones that are going to really invest themselves. And then you love investing in them. And seeing people grow and develop, and incredibly proud of the teams that I've been a part of, and incredibly proud of a lot of the people that I've been able to work with and watch what they're doing today. And it's mate, it's awesome. And we only worked together for a handful of years, but seeing what you're doing at Boost and not only that, but across the wider industry also is just terrific. It needs people like you who are investing in it and offering advice and insight and experience, guidance to people out there. Yeah, what a terrific industry it is to be part of. So, mate, it's been fun catching up and chatting. Ethical dilemmas. I didn't know that was what we'd next talk about, but there you go.
Well, mate, I thank you for tackling this one with me, and I think that was a cracking chat. And, mate, I'm sure I will see you, but, you know, when you do land at QMS, all the very best with it. It's going to be exciting to see what the future holds for you, mate.
Oh, great business, 10-year-old business that's done incredibly well to be in a position they are. I'm looking forward to, yeah, getting into it with the team over there. Great group of people, and yeah, it'll be eye-opening, but I'm excited about the challenge that it represents, and looking forward to, yeah, cracking back in Feb next year. 2023 has been a very funny year, but yeah, to come up for air has been wonderful. I've got to know my family, and I quite like them, so that was good to know, and yeah, looking forward to getting back into it all next year. And Nate, thank you, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Tim.